It's an expensive one.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Coming up on the program, Faith Perlow has a story about a project that aims to help refugees by giving them handmade blankets. Brian Lynn has this week's technology report on the 50th year of the cell phone. The inventor of the cell phone, Martin Cooper, has mixed feelings about the popularity of his invention. Later, we present the next part in our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
an effort called the Welcome Blanket Project aims to help refugees by giving them handmade blankets. The project has grown over the years. Recently, Welcome Blanket showed at least 86 blankets at the Heritage Mill Museum in Winooski, Vermont. The blankets were made by people who sewed, crocheted, and knitted them. The person who made the blanket then attaches a handwritten note. The blankets were then given to refugees. The national group describes its efforts as an artistic action that supports refugees settling in the United States. Jana Zweinman is an activist based in Los Angeles. She started Welcome Blanket in 2017, in opposition to former President Donald Trump's support for a wall at the U.S. border with Mexico. She is a grandchild of refugees and grew up hearing stories about her grandfather seeing the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. She said it made him feel welcome. She wanted people coming to this country now to have the same feeling that her grandfather had, as well as so many other immigrants. She wanted a way to help them. Since that time, thousands of blankets and notes have been made for shows across the country. After the blankets are displayed, they are given away in welcome boxes to refugees and immigrants at the event or through local charity groups. The project started to help refugees who were forced to leave their countries because of war, persecution, or a natural disaster. The blankets have also gone to immigrants. Aisha Bettini came to the U.S. from Congo in Africa. She is now living in the state of Vermont. She said that she loves the blanket she chose, a soft crocheted one with gold, dark red, white, and gray colors. She picked it out at a blanket giveaway at the Association of Africans Living in Vermont. "I'm so blessed to have one of them," she said. "This beautiful blanket and the note that came with it made her feel so special." Kalyan Adhikari is from Nepal. He said the Vermont Project makes refugees feel welcomed and more at home. He said that the project is such a kind and warm initiative. "This makes my heart warm. I can't thank them enough," he said about the blanket makers. Holly Shanner McRae is from Burlington, Vermont. She made one of the blankets being shown in March at the Heritage Hill Museum. The blanket is purple with white and gray stripes. On a note she placed on her blanket, she wrote about her great-grandparents coming to America from Ukraine, Russia, and Poland. Her note said, "Welcome to the USA." One of her great-grandfathers made clothing by hand, and the other made large wooden containers. Both were so brave and came to America as teenagers, she wrote in the note. I hope you make friends and feel safe here. Vermont is blessed to have new families arrive and enrich our world, she continued in her note. Sonia Savulian lives in Los Angeles in the state of California. She is an immigrant herself and makes things with yarn. She started making blankets in 2018. Since then, she has made about 50 blankets. Savulian said that the Welcome Blanket Project is both a creative activity for the people who make them, and it is a product that helps people new to the U.S. feel an embrace, a welcome, and an aspiration, she said. Jana Zweinman hopes that the blanket making will become a tradition in the U.S. I want this happening 50 years from now, she said. And I want a kid who took part in this to remember that he had actually physically made something for someone who was coming. I'm Faith Perlow.
The first cell phone was invented 50 years ago this week. The man who built that phone, Martin Cooper, is now 94 years old. Cooper, who has been called the father of the cell phone, has been speaking with the media as he looks back at his efforts to create a device that greatly changed our world. In the early 1970s, Cooper worked for American technology company Motorola. At the time, Motorola and other manufacturers were attempting to create wireless phones that could work in vehicles and also be carried. There was intense competition between Motorola, Bell Labs, and AT&T to build the first truly portable phone. The technology used to create the first cell phone is known as cellular. This technology uses many small interconnected transmitters that give off wireless signals and connect cell phones to the Internet. Cooper made the first public call from a handheld portable telephone in New York City on April 3, 1973. The device, called Dynatac, weighed about 1 kilogram and was 28 centimeters long. He developed the phone with his team at Motorola over a period of 5 months. The first model permitted about 25 minutes of talk time. Cooper noted that such a talk time was not a problem since this phone was so heavy you couldn't hold it up for 25 minutes. Speaking about that moment to the Associated Press, Cooper said, "The only thing that I was worried about is this thing going to work." And it did. Cooper admitted that at the time, we had no way of knowing this was a historic moment. While Cooper is pleased that his invention has opened up a series of technological possibilities for cell phone users, he thinks many people are just too obsessed with their devices. I am devastated when I see somebody crossing the street and looking at their cell phone. They are out of their minds, Cooper told the AP. But after a few people get run over by cars, they'll figure it out, he joked. Today, Cooper uses a late-model iPhone. He likes that the phone permits him to do numerous things, such as read emails, watch YouTube, and control his hearing aid devices. But mostly, he says he uses the phone just to talk to people. Cooper said the modern progress of cell phones is sure to continue long into the future. He predicts phones will develop to the point of being able to be distributed on your body, with sensors measuring your health at all times. Cooper said batteries could even be replaced by human energy. You ingest food, you create energy. Why not have this receiver for your ear embedded under your skin, powered by your body, he imagined. But the cell phone inventor has also expressed worries about how the device has created serious risks for users, especially in the area of privacy. My most negative opinion is we don't have any privacy anymore because everything about us is now recorded someplace, Cooper said. But he noted he is hopeful that cell phones will continue to progress in ways that can greatly help humanity. Each generation is going to be smarter. They will learn how to use the cell phone more effectively, Cooper said. Humans, sooner or later, figure it out. I'm Brian Lynn.
Brian Lynn joins me now to talk more about his technology report. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Sure, Dan. Thanks for having me.
This week's report dealt with the 50th anniversary of the cell phone. And while it might be hard to believe the cell phone has been around for so long, it's safe to say that most people in the world did not even start using one until much later than that. The report centered on the thoughts of the inventor of the cell phone, Martin Cooper. What is he saying about his invention now?
Yes, so Martin Cooper says, of course, he's pleased with how far the technology has developed and how people can now use their phones to do many more things than just talk. He personally uses a newer iPhone and says he's always interested in learning about the latest features when the new devices are released.
The technology report also mentions some of the negative opinions Cooper has about the risks mobile phones present, as well as his concerns about how people are currently using their phones. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, so one thing Cooper expresses deep concern about is the loss of privacy that cell phone users can experience. Specifically, he dislikes the fact that phones are now used as an easy way for companies to collect private user information, and oftentimes unknowingly. And Cooper has also warned that people are putting too much time and attention into their cell phones, in his opinion. But on the other hand, he said he has high hopes that today's phones will continue to develop in ways that will greatly help humanity.
Very interesting. Thanks again for joining me, Brian.
You're welcome. Thank you, Dan.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The presidential election of 1928 gave American voters a clear political choice. The Democratic Party nominated Al Smith. He was the popular governor of the state of New York. The Republican Party chose Herbert Hoover. He was an engineer and businessman who served as Secretary of Commerce for Presidents Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Rich Kleinfeld and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidential election of 1928.
Governor Alfred Smith of New York had campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1924. But he was defeated at the party convention by a compromise candidate, John Davis. 4 years later, however, Smith could not be stopped. He had a strong record as governor of the nation's most heavily populated state. He campaigned for the presidency on a policy of building new electric power stations under public control. Smith knew that many conservative Americans might be worried by his new ideas and his belief in strong government. So he chose as his campaign manager a Republican industrial leader who had worked with General Motors, DuPont, and other major companies. Smith hoped this would prove his faith in the American private business system.
Al Smith was a strong political leader and an effective governor, but he frightened many Americans, especially conservative citizens living in rural areas. They lived on farms or in small towns. Al Smith was from the city, and not just from any city, but New York City, a place that seemed big and dirty and filled with foreign people and strange traditions. Al Smith's parents came from Ireland. He grew up in New York and worked as a salesman at the Fulton Fish Market. Smith was an honest man, but many rural Americans simply did not trust people from big cities. Al Smith seemed to them to represent everything that was new, different, and dangerous about American life. But being from New York City was not Al Smith's only problem. He also opposed the new national laws that made it illegal to buy or produce alcoholic drinks. And he had political ties to the New York political machine. but worst of all in the eyes of many Americans. Al Smith was a Roman Catholic.
From George Washington through Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and up to Calvin Coolidge, every American president had been male, white, and a Protestant Christian. Of course, there was no law requiring a candidate to be Protestant, but millions of traditional Americans just were not ready to give their vote to a Roman Catholic. Opponents of the Smith campaign generally did not speak openly about his religion, but many of them were afraid that Smith would take his orders from the Vatican in Rome instead of working with the Congress in Washington. Al Smith fought back. He told the country, "I am unable to understand how anything I was taught to believe as a Catholic could possibly be in conflict with what is good citizenship. My faith," he said, "is built upon the laws of God. There can be no conflict between them."
But many Protestant Americans thought there was a conflict, and they looked to the Republican Party to supply a strong candidate to oppose Smith and the Democrats. The Republicans did just that. They nominated former Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, one of the country's most popular men. Hoover was well known to Americans. People trusted him, and they liked the way he had gained great personal success from poor beginnings. In fact, Hoover's life story would have pleased Abraham Lincoln, another American who rose from a poor family to fame. Hoover was born in the farm state of Iowa in 1874. His father was a poor metal worker who kept moving his family from state to state. Herbert Hoover's father died when the boy was just 6 years old. His mother died 4 years later. Young Herbert had to move to the western state of Oregon to live with his mother's brother. Herbert's uncle was luckier in life than Herbert's parents. He had made money in the land business, and he helped the boy gain admission to Stanford University in California. At the university, Herbert showed great skill in mathematics, and he decided to go into business as a geologist, studying the science of the earth.
After college, Herbert Hoover got a job as a mine worker. During the next several years, Hoover spent most of his time working as an engineer in foreign countries. And he succeeded beyond his greatest dreams. By the time he was 40 years old, he had earned more than $1 million. After World War I, he organized the effort to provide food for starving people in Europe. He did an excellent job, winning praise from people in Europe and the United States alike. Next, Hoover joined the administration of President Warren Harding, serving as the Secretary of Commerce. Again, he did a very good job. Hoover left the cabinet in 1925. But 2 years later, he organized efforts to provide relief for victims of a flood in the southern state of Mississippi. And again, Americans all around the country took note of this quiet, serious man who did such effective work in so many different kinds of situations. Some Americans, however, did not like Hoover, including some people who usually supported Republicans. For example, many professional Republican politicians did not trust him because he had spent most of his life in business, not politics. Some stock market traders thought Hoover might change the rules on the New York Stock Exchange. And many farmers believed Hoover had no new ideas about how to solve their growing economic problems.
This, then, was the choice Americans faced in 1928. On the one hand, Al Smith, a Democrat, a Roman Catholic, a politician from the city, a man wanting some social change. And on the other hand, Herbert Hoover, a Republican, a businessman who had proven the dream that even a poor boy could become great in America, a man who seemed to succeed with every effort he touched. The main issue in the campaign was not economics or religion, but the new national laws banning alcoholic drinks. Hoover was for the laws, Smith against them. The two candidates also argued about how to provide aid to struggling farmers and how to increase electricity and water supplies.
Herbert Hoover won the election of 1928. It was one of the greatest victories in presidential history. Hoover won 58% of the votes. Smith got just 40%. And Hoover captured 444 electoral votes to Smith's 87. And so it was that the engineer and businessman, Herbert Hoover, entered the White House in 1929. There was some trouble the day he moved in. Outgoing President Coolidge was a man who watched every dollar he owned. And he accused some White House workers of stealing his shoes on the day of the inauguration. But finally, safe, conservative, businesslike Herbert Hoover was leading the country.
The nation's stock market reacted by pushing stock prices to record high levels. Everyone expected that economic growth would continue and expand. But the happy times were just a dream. Within 1 year, the stock market collapsed. Millions of people lost their jobs. The nation fell into the worst economic crisis it had ever faced. Herbert Hoover was not personally responsible for the crisis. In many ways, it was his own bad luck to be elected just before the disaster struck. But it was his job to guide the nation through its troubled waters. And he would prove to be the wrong person to give such leadership. His 4 years in office would be one of the most difficult periods in the nation's history.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.